So for those of you who were here last week, I talked a little bit about loving kindness, and I thought that today I would talk about compassion. And loving kindness is the first of the what's called in Buddhism the Brahma Viharas, and compassion is loving kindness is the first, and compassion is the second. And it's a very interesting word, this word Brahma Vihara. It's sometimes translated into English as meaning the divine abode. Brahma is the supreme god or a certain kind of heavenly realm in Buddhist cosmology. And Vihara means abode or a dwelling place or a monastery. So the abode or the monastery or the dwelling place of Brahma. And Brahma, or this Brahmanic place in the heavenly realms, is considered to be one filled with delight, certain kind of joy or some kind of pleasure. So one way to experience the abode of Brahma, this divine abode, before you get to heaven here on the earth, is to cultivate these four qualities that make up the Brahma Viharas. So to cultivate loving kindness, to cultivate compassion, to cultivate sympathetic joy, and to cultivate equanimity. And these are the four, what I call the four kinds of love that the Buddha taught. And what makes this love different from the kind of love that we often see in popular songs and places is that it's a kind of love that has no attachment as part of it. There's no clinging as part of it. There's no wanting something in return, to be loved in return. It's a kind of an expression that comes out of us. Sometimes I imagine it's like a furnace. The furnace just produces all this heat and doesn't ask for anything in return, I guess. It just kind of radiates. So these Brahma Viharas are things that radiate from us. And are considered quite beautiful, the abode of the divine abodes. In our particular Buddhist tradition, there's a lot of emphasis placed on cultivating the first one, metta, or loving kindness. And the second one gets some emphasis, the third gets the least, and equanimity gets a fair amount of emphasis also. It's hard for me to imagine Buddhist practice without the Brahma Viharas, without this warmth or this radiance or this love affair that comes with these qualities. And in particular, it's hard for me to imagine Buddhism without compassion, the quality of compassion. And as I was coming down here today, I was thinking to ask you a question. I don't know if it's a good question to ask, but what would you rather? Would you rather have someone tell you that they love you, or to have someone tell you that they care for you? So probably depending on how you define those terms, you have different answers. We don't all share the same definition, but at least the question points to the possibility that caring for someone can be quite a beautiful way of relating to someone. And or to be related from someone. Someone relates to us, they care for us. And love without care, without the caring, in Buddhist understanding, is not love at all. So there has to be some caring of the other person, some caring, some concern. One of the words that I like as a synonym for mindfulness is the term attending. So we don't just watch our breath or follow our breath. We attend to the breath in mindfulness practice. And attending has much more of a caring quality, something we tend to. We bring more of ourselves, kind of a listening, caring presence to tend to the experience of breathing. So it's not we're not watching in kind of a neutral way. So this idea of tending. When I was living in the monastery in Tassajara, I was there for about 6 months. And I was assigned to the garden. And to be the gardener. And before work started every day, there was this kind of break time in the morning for, I don't know, 20 minutes or so. And I would go into my garden, and I would just go around and look at all the plants. And I just loved it. It was like tending to all these little creatures, all these little beings, all these pieces of life. And I just look at them, and how are you doing today? And I mean, I say it this way, it sounds kind of silly. It was this love affair, this kind of caring, this tending. And it wasn't self-conscious in the sense that I was planning to do this. I would find myself wandering into the garden, just wandering around the beds, looking at the plants, tending to them with this kind of feeling of caring or tending, or I would maybe stretch to say some kind of compassion. That I think back at that time, this is a time in my life where I was doing a lot of meditation practice. I was in a monastery, spent a lot of the time meditating. And one of the things that happens when you meditate a lot is that the kind of barriers or the defenses we might have for caring for the heart to care for some quality of resonance and feeling of sympathy or empathy, the barriers to that empathy kind of fade away, dissolve away. And since my job was to be in the garden, that empathy translated to these plants. A little embarrassed to tell you that, because plants, you know, it's kind of silly. But this feeling of tending. So in Buddhism, these Brahmaviharas are considered very important, and compassion for some Buddhists is considered to be the most important, because compassion is what motivates us, what motivates some people to engage in the spiritual life. Some people are motivated for other reasons besides compassion, but it's sometimes said only by compassion can one follow the path all the way to the end. Only with having some motivation of compassion. So in other words, somehow you understand that your spiritual life, your Buddhist practice, is somehow related to the practice or the well-being of others. And without that sense of empathy, that sense of connectedness, then it's very hard to take the path all the way to the end. And the argument is that you're not going to have the sufficient motivation on your own to take it all the way. One of the ways you see this is that after people practice for some time, and different people, it's different lengths of time, the basic personal motivation that brought them to practice meditation or do Buddhist practice has been satisfied. Somehow, some people come with great distress or great suffering or great loneliness or great something. And so they're motivated to practice to deal with their suffering. And then, after a while, that suffering abates. And it's no longer strong enough so that it can be motivating. And so then, people sometimes will get on with their life. Whatever their life is about, something else to motivate them. However, if in the course of that practice, that person feels that their practice is supportive and helpful, is connected to the welfare of others, then that becomes a motivation to continue the practice. It isn't just for me anymore, but it's also for others. So how is it that my practice is supporting for others? How can we make that connection? So it's said that compassion will take you all the way. In some schools of Buddhism, a tremendous emphasis is put on cultivating and developing compassion. So with all these forms of love, these four kinds, what we say in Buddhism is that you don't have to leave them to chance. It doesn't have to be a matter of chemistry. That somehow it happens. You put in a want ad, and that's not what it's called, right? A personal ad in the paper. And, somehow the right person answers the ad, or I don't know how it all happens. No one really knows how it happens, right? But it's chemistry, we say, because that makes it mysterious, doesn't explain anything. But in Buddhism, what we say is you don't have to leave love to chance, but it's something you can cultivate and develop. And what that implies is that love is not contingent upon the other person. So in other words, it's not contingent upon the chemistry between people, but it's contingent upon the chemistry inside of yourself. And that you could somehow change yourself. You can change that chemistry. And if you change the chemistry inside of you, then one of the products of that change is love. So we don't leave love to chance, but rather it can be cultivated and developed. It can be developed and cultivated unintentionally by doing practice. At least for some people, it's a common for as people develop more and more mindfulness, more and more concentration, more and more stability of mind, that their capacity for empathy grows and grows. And that empathy translates, I think, directly to being able to love more, to feel kindness or friendliness, or to feel compassion when someone suffers. But also it's possible to do practices that cultivate these four brahmaviharas. And it's possible to do a meditation practice, a variety of meditation practices, that cultivate and strengthen compassion within us. I've read it that an ancient Buddhist teacher said, compassion is a seed, compassion is the water, and compassion is the fruit. So in other words, at the beginning of practice, compassion can be this little seed that's there. And it's a seed that has potential, that can grow. But compassion is also the water that nourishes or the seed and makes it grow. And compassion is also the fruit when the plant has grown and has borne fruit. Compassion is all those things. Compassion is always there and always present, and it can bloom and blossom within us. So, and then how is compassion developed? One of the ways, there's many ways, but the most, for some people, the most direct way is by doing a meditation practice on compassion. And this is, in our tradition, the way it's usually done is you first think of someone for whom it's relatively or very, very easy for you to have compassion. Easy to have uncomplicated compassion. What that means is that you have empathy for their suffering and you wish for that suffering to be alleviated, to come to an end. That's the definition the Buddhist definition of compassion is the quivering of the heart in the presence of suffering and then the desire to somehow alleviate that suffering or desire that suffering be alleviated. So, in meditation, one would first calm oneself down, settle the mind a little bit from the normal way it is running around, and once the mind is somewhat settled, to bring to mind some person for whom it's relatively easy for you to have empathetic concern, someone who's suffering. You don't want to have someone who suffering is too great, where you might feel anxiety or distress, but for someone where it's relatively clean and straightforward. So you might consider someone who's, maybe isn't suffering very much. Or different people, it means a different kind of person. But you think of someone. It could be a friend. It could be a stranger. It could be someone you read about in the news. It could be all kinds of different situations. But you think of someone where somehow your heart vibrates or resonates with their suffering. You feel it in some way. And it's relatively easy for you to have that feeling of tending or caring for that person's suffering. So that the words, the sentence, may you be free of your suffering, gives voice to a feeling in your heart, a feeling inside of you. And that's very important for me when I do this, that it somehow, because when I try to do this practice by saying the words, may you be free of suffering, I get bored really quickly and it feels really flat. I have to find some place in me where there's wordless caring for the other person. Or sometimes a wordless caring that's even before I even think of a person. And then, once that wordless caring is there, to give it voice. And the voice, the usual way, the classic phrase to say, is may you be free of your suffering. And then you say that. And so you can set up a nice rhythm. It's very nice. I find it's very nice to set up a rhythm where to bring the person to mind, feel the person's suffering, and then give voice to the caring. May you be free of your suffering. May you be free of your pain. And then pause to take in the person again, and then say the phrases. So it's a kind of a pause and then a giving, a pause, taking it in, feeling it, and then giving it, getting into a rhythm like that. And when it's done, do I dare say right, when it's done right, when it's done well, or as it's meant to be, then oddly enough, a feeling of well-being arises in the person who's doing the meditation practice. And why I say oddly is that some people think when we feel compassion for others, we're supposed to feel distressed. We're supposed to feel, you know, somehow worry for the person, or be angry about the situation, or distressed, or something. But the expectation here is that when the compassion is clean, that actually produces a sense of well-being that's actually very pleasant. So it's very strange that that's the case. Does that sound strange to you? It's said that if the loving kindness gives if the compassion practice gives rise to grief or distress, then stop doing it. And maybe go back to doing loving kindness practice or doing mindfulness practice until you're settled again, and you can try again. It's also said that anxiety or grief or distress are the near enemies of compassion. And the near enemy are those qualities that look like compassion and are mistaken for compassion, but are not compassion. So sometimes anxiety or distress or worry is taken as a form of compassion, but it's not really compassion, because compassion, when it's clean, has no anxiety, no grief, no distress, no sadness as part of it. So it's a whole practice in itself then to begin sorting out the difference between distress or grief and compassion in this kind of pure sense. And it's really a worthwhile exploration and teasing apart that can happen. I've known people who have felt tremendous amount of what they call compassion that came together with a tremendous experience of distress at certain kinds of suffering. So I know one person member who felt tremendous, overwhelming distress in the suffering of stray cats. Somehow the cats was something really got this person. Or sometimes other categories of certain kinds of suffering that really kind of seemed almost too much. And they thought they were very compassionate. Maybe they were a certain degree of compassion. But what I've seen over and over again is the people who are overwhelmed by the suffering of others tend to have unresolved pain in themselves, unresolved suffering of their own. And what's happening is the suffering of the world, suffering of others, is somehow like salt on the wound of our own suffering. And so it's very important then to be able to go in and bring a salve or bring a healing to our own wounds so that our compassion for others can be clean or beautiful or healthy or healed or whatever. And this brings the very important point of being able to do compassion practice for oneself. In other words, or to tend to oneself, to care for oneself. It's hard for me to imagine that any meditation practice would go very far unless the person who's doing it has some caring for themselves. So they're willing to tend to themselves with care, whether it's to their breath or to their whatever their meditation experience might be. But self-compassion is sometimes short supply. So some people, it's a completely foreign concept that they would have compassion for themselves. It's okay to have compassion for others because you're required to do that, right? There's a duty that you're all supposed to be compassionate for others. But it's considered selfish to be compassionate for yourself. That's kind of self-indulging or something. And the best thing you can do is just suffer a lot so that you show your care or atone for your past deeds, or I don't know. I don't understand, but the good arguments why you should suffer. But people have them because I know some people are attached to their suffering. They cling to it very tightly sometimes. But to somehow to turn our suffering, turn ourselves around so that we can be caring for ourselves. May I be free of suffering. May I be free of pain. And to do it not as a mantra, words, just kind of empty words, but do it because there's some place of stillness perhaps inside of ourselves where we feel for ourselves, we care for ourselves, where there's empathy for ourselves, where there's warmth for ourselves or openness to ourselves, something. The argument is that everyone is equally deserving of our suffering, of our love. Everyone's equally deserving of our care. Just as much, and everyone means we're one of those people. So how to do that for ourselves as much as we would do it for anybody else? And how to do it for other people just as much as we do it for ourselves? So in all directions. So you find in classic Buddhism various reflections that people are encouraged to do to cultivate compassion and develop this quality. And one of them is to do the exercise of imagining yourself as others, or others as yourself. Imagine, so you put yourself in other people's shoes. Or imagine imagine yourself in their shoes. What would it be like for you to be in that kind of situation? To kind of change places with people. And in that exercise, begin feeling their situation almost firsthand. And in doing that, not holding yourself at distance or judging or aloof from the person, but actually feeling what that person is like. So that's said to cultivate more sense of compassion. That sense of seeing others as oneself, or oneself as others, is supposed to heal the particular kind of suffering that takes the form of pity, where we kind of are considered to be kind of better than others or higher than others, or you know, we're looking down, oh, poor person down there. And that's not considered healthy. What's healthy is to see others as equals in the suffering and not to be kind of above someone. The other reflection has to do with kind of Buddhist classic mythology or cosmology, is the idea that everyone in the distant past of all these different lifetimes we've lived, everyone, at one point or other, has been our mother or our father or our sister or our brother or our lover or our children or something. You see a little snail walking on the ground, you know. Yes, once upon a time, I bet, you know. You know, you're my mother. And because the time goes back an infinite amount of time, you know, you had a chance to be every possible life form. So that possible relationship. So to me, that little teaching reminds me of the, I think, the Native Americans, Sioux, Dakota Sioux Dakotas, have this expression, all my relations. Anybody know how to say it in Sioux? Anybody know how to say it? No? I've forgotten. Yes?
I think someone says ho matakina.
That sounds familiar. So they say all my relations. And so I like this kind of mythology that we're all been related in the past. I don't know if it's true, but I kind of like it as a symbol or to represent the fact that we are very, very connected to each other. The sense of interconnectedness and interdependence that we all have with each other. And then the third form of reflection that's supposed to give birth to compassion is the reflection of how interdependent we are. And I've noticed that when I've gone to some countries in the world where you don't expect the train to come on time, or the buses to work, that I feel pretty grateful when things work, And then when I've been in countries like here, where the telephone repair person doesn't come, you know, within 24 hours, that's irritating. And, you know, compared to other countries, we have to wait a month before they come, you know, and that's, they come after 3 weeks, and you say, wow, that's great. We have, you know, in this culture here, things are so amazingly, work so well for us. And I think many times, for myself, I take it for granted. And that's taking it for granted, I've come to expect it sometimes, and I consider it an irritation when things don't work. But when I, but the fact that so much works so well, it's an immense number of human beings that are responsible for the fact that I could drive down the road, buy gas, you know, buy food, you know, all the different things that we do. My telephones work, you know, and all things. It's just immense what goes on. Today I was up in the San Carlos Canyons, kind of hiking on a little trail up there for a little bit. And I had a reason to talk to someone on the phone. And strange place for that, I guess, but no, this is never a strange place for a phone call anymore. And I was amazed that the phone worked back there, the cell phone, you know, worked way back there in the canyon. Wow, what's it doing back here? And so how often do we feel grateful that for all the innumerable labors that are responsible for how we get by and get through our day here? So I don't know if it does it for you, but one of the classic reflections to cultivate or awaken compassion is reflection on how our interdependence and how so much of our life is dependent on the efforts of others. So the near enemy of compassion is anxiety or grief or sadness. The far enemy of compassion is cruelty. The near enemy looks like compassion and is confused for it. The far enemy is that which is obviously different, and so different that it destroys compassion. So cruelty, hostility. To the degree, but however, compassion is considered to be the antidote for cruelty. And I've seen sometimes that I've gotten angry with people. How could that person have done that? It happened just this last week. Someone did something which he shouldn't have done. And it was actually kind of disrespectful. And I went through in my mind, how am I going to give this person a piece of my mind? I had a kind of little plan in my mind. And then I thought, you know, this is silly. What a waste of my neurons. And I thought about it for a while. So I started thinking about this person and kind of taking the person in, kind of imagining the person, kind of had a sense of the person, remembering the person, what the person looks like, and kind of taking the person in. And so the person wasn't the person out there, somehow at a distance, kind of walled off from my heart. But I kind of took the person in to really, like, we're familiar, like we're friends or close. And it was kind of hard then to be angry at this person. And that, so that felt like an improvement. But we still had this problem. We still had this issue. I didn't want to just forgive the issue. And so now I have a new plan. And that is, I thought, you know, it's actually, I think it would work a lot better to tell the person that I was hurt. And by saying I'm hurt, my defenses can still stay down. My closed offness can still not be present. I can still be open and relaxed and kind of be present for the person, take the person in. And then we'll see how the person responds when I say that. Maybe that person will put up his armor or bring out the weapons, because sometimes people do that. But you know, I thought, well, that's a better way. Let's see what happens in the conversation if I say that I was hurt. Maybe that kind of can, maybe actually, sometimes I've done that with people, and it actually helps, and people have done it to me, because it helps, because they don't lift up their defenses. And then you can meet more like human beings. So in doing the meditation practice on compassion, these classic instructions to start with whoever it's easiest to do it for. For some people it's for themselves, for some people it's definitely not themselves. And it might be a friend, it might be some distant person, but do it where it's easiest. And then, in a progressive way, begin doing it for people where it's harder and harder to feel compassion for. So first you do it somewhere it's easy, and then you might do it for someone who is almost as easy as the first person, but not quite. And then you kind of stretch yourself to see what it takes. See what needs to be clarified inside of yourself, what you have to work out, so that your feeling of care can become equal as you had for the first person. And then you go to the next more difficult, or you begin moving out a little bit, moving out. And then eventually you do it for people for whom you have no obvious and easy caring feelings for, but you have no hostility either. They're just neutral. So what is it to have then compassion or care for people whom you feel neutral for? And it takes some stretching, working things out to find out, can I do it for that person too? And then the final instruction is to, or the next instruction is to do it for people who you have difficulty with, including people who might actually want you to do you harm. So what is it to do it for people who actually want to do harm to you? Your enemies. And why would you? So then there's a whole thing that happens then. And this is not supposed to be kind of a light thing where you just kind of say, oh yes, I'll do it. But it's a really time for really careful reflection and thought and consideration and feeling. What's going on there with people who are my enemies, who I have hostility towards, or who have hostility towards me? What would it take to open my heart for that person? What would it take to have a caring feeling for that person also? And it might take months or years to kind of explore that and work it out. Maybe it takes a lot of talking with friends or exploring different issues that we have. But to find, what does it take? And I think what's really beautiful is when someone wants to do the work to discover how that's possible. It's nice if they can do it, but simply to want to do it, even though it might take a year or 10 years, to want to explore what will it take to have compassion for my enemies? May you be happy. May you be free of your suffering. For some people, it can be easier to do compassion practice for difficult people, for enemies, if there's an understanding that their behavior, their difficult behavior, is arising out of their own suffering. I don't know, this came to mind just now, but this evening before coming down here, I was playing with my 3-year-old. I wasn't playing with him, but I was in the bedroom with him, and he was playing with his train set. And he was really happy. And I was superfluous. And I just sat there and watched. And he was singing, and he was so happy. And I had this thought, maybe I'm superfluous, maybe I can go do something else. And I said, no, maybe not. Because maybe he's happy because I'm there with him. And then the telephone rang. And the telephone rang, and I talked on the phone. And as soon as I answered the phone, he became impossibly unhappy. Nothing worked. The train was knocking it over. He was unhappy with the whole train, and you know, nothing. And you know, I realized how much, you know, he was valuing my company, even though I was just sitting there watching. And that then, when that was taken away from him, there was a certain kind of pain there. So, because in that situation it was easy to identify his pain, I could feel, I could understand, oh, you know, his mean-spirited way of being right now, this is not to be disciplined. Send him to his room, you know. How could you treat me that way? How could you be that way? I'm talking on the phone. Be respectful. But rather, you know, I could have some care, concern, and say, oh, there's something more going on, more deeply going on here. A three-year-old who needs the presence of his father for a while. I hadn't spent much time with him today. And you know, he had it, and he was taking it in, even though there was no, you know, I was just watching. So difficult people, to have some sense of the suffering that's prompting their difficult behavior, can sometimes help open up the heart and have some sense of compassion. Now the beautiful thing about doing compassion meditation is that the person you're having compassion for, like if you do it for an enemy, doesn't have to know. You're not really doing it for their sake. You're doing it for your own sake. So you're not. So sometimes people say, I can't do it for that terrible person because then I'll be defenseless. Then the person will take advantage of me, or that person, you know, will feel like it was okay to do what she did or something. But the person doesn't have to know you're doing it. It could be something that's very private. It might not be safe to show someone else how open-hearted you are, how you feel for them. But you can keep it private. Cultivate an open heart, a warm heart, that's private for however long it needs to be private, as opposed to a guarded heart. And so the final thing to say is that all these Brahmaviharas, but including compassion here, is meant to occur together with an ability to see clearly. So what that means is that it's not meant to be sentimental or sugary, or it's not meant to kind of avoid or ignore or have blinders on in regards to people's faults or the difficult things there that are also there. You know, it's said that the popular kind of love that you have songs about, sometimes you say it puts on, people put on rose-colored glasses as a result. And they just see everything that's wonderful about that person. Wow, you know, that's the best person's the best, wow. And then you wake up the next morning with the person there next to you and, what was I thinking? And somehow the rose-colored glasses have been taken off. Sometimes it happens overnight, and sometimes it takes 20 or 30 years. But there can be this rose-colored glasses kind of syndrome. And the idea with compassion practice is that we're not supposed to have any kind of rose-colored glasses on at all. We're supposed to be clear-seeing, clear-thinking about what's actually there, not denying anything. And then because of that clear-seeing, or with that clear-seeing, then to find out what it's like to have caring concern for the other. So I don't know how this talk has been taken by you today, but for me, this idea, the quality of compassion is completely central to my own practice of my own Buddhist practice. I think it's inseparable. It's the very heart of it, the core of it, and I would say that pretty much all my motivation in practice is somehow or other feeds back to or is related to the compassion that I have slowly developed and cultivated over these years.